part of the work is doing the work with zero confidence. It actually is the job of a writer and an artist to do it anyway, even though it might not work, even though someone else could do it better, even though you might feel like you're wasting your time. Because the reality is someone else can do it better, and they probably already have, but that doesn't mean you can't do it too.
Welcome to the Habit Podcast, conversations with writers about writing. I'm Jonathan Rogers, your host. Emily P. Freeman spends a lot of time thinking, talking, and writing about discernment and decision-making, doing the next right thing. She hosts the Next Right Thing podcast and created the Next Right Thing Guided Journal. Her latest book is How to Walk Into a Room, The Art of Knowing When to Stay and When to Walk Away. In this conversation, Emily and I talk about pointing and calling, the difference between discernment and decision-making, and the counterintuitive truth that when it comes to discerning the next best step, remembering is more important than predicting. Emily P. Freeman, I'm so glad to have you on the Habit Podcast. Thanks for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
I'm excited about your new book, How to Walk Into a Room, which when I first heard that you'd written a book with that title, I thought it was about personal style or something like that. It intrigued me. It's really about discernment. Is that fair to say? Is that how you would summarize what this book is about?
Absolutely. And if we had to just pick one word, I think that would be the word for it. The subtitle helps to clarify the art of knowing when to stay and when to walk away. So it's funny, I had a reader tell me that her 7-year-old saw the book laying on the coffee table and was like, how to walk into a room? Well, that's a silly thing to write a whole book about it. I can do it right now.
And you call it How to Walk into a Room because the governing metaphor is the idea that your life is a house and there are rooms that it's time to leave one room and move on to another. Hopefully that was a good summary of your controlling metaphor.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think we all kind of know what that's like different commitments, relationships, things that we're involved in. If we think of them as various rooms of our life, and then in many ways, we're always entering a room, we're always hanging out in a room, and we're probably always about to leave another room. And so that's sort of the picture in my mind of, you know, the different commitments that we have in life is just thinking of them as different rooms.
Yeah. You talk about the idea. I'd love to start here. You said the discernment process is not necessarily about asking a question and coming out with a clear answer. Discernment is a formation process. You say it's about becoming wholehearted people and leading confidently from that space. I'm really interested in that idea that the discernment process is not necessarily about asking a question and coming out with a clear answer. I thought that was the definition of discernment. So tell me, say more about that. I'd love to hear you talk about what discernment means when it doesn't mean having a clear answer.
I love that. I think that's what we want the discernment process to be, is to have a question, you come out with a clear answer. And I think ultimately we get there. But a lot of times we treat discernment the way we treat decision-making. Mm-hmm. And they are two different processes. And I think if we all sat down and looked at our own lives, we'd be like, oh yeah, that is different. You know, a decision is sort of like, who's going to drive our 10-year-old to piano? Me or you? You know, that's, you're making a decision. There's no discernment needed there. Yeah. Maybe, but mostly not. But when it comes to things like our vocation, matters of money, faith, relationship, the things that like really matter and have big consequence, rarely, not always, but rarely do we ask the question and then our next step is an answer. More often, it's a process of following what I call arrows to just one next right thing. I may not know where I'm going to end up, but I'm going to engage in some practices and processes and maybe some type of framework to help me discern where ultimately I'm going to go. And part of that process, depending on your social location, depending on what your core values are, depending on who you are and the people around you, that's going to inform what that process looks like for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the way you talk about the process more in terms of who you are, who the decision maker is, even more so than what are the external factors.
Yeah, that's right.
And you know, it does seem like when you read, I don't know, some sort of business book, decision making is looking on the horizon, seeing the factors. I mean, even that language of looking on the horizon, you question, right? I mean, as you say, you can't see the path in front of you. You can only see the path behind you, which is a really important insight from your book.
I mean, that's been an important insight in my life, is that I have found that really, when I get down to it, the best indicator for my future decisions, to make them in wisdom, is my greatest teachers are the decisions I've already made and the mm-hmm. discernment process I've already walked through. And there's a lot of pressure when we have something that we're trying to discern, a room that we're considering entering or leaving. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of pressure to get it right. And also sometimes there's time pressure to like get it right now. And I would say that sometimes that pressure itself can cloud the process itself. And some of us rush out of a room before it's time just because we don't like that tension of holding the line, holding the tension a little bit longer, as Parker Palmer talks about. We just want to get the thing over with already. Mm-hmm. And then others of us don't like that tension. So we do the opposite. We stay in a space maybe too long or longer than mm-hmm. time because we don't like the idea of the unknown. So there's a lot at play here. But I do think, like you said, the formation that can happen in our inner lives in this process is really profound. And it's been, I mean, it's, you know, when I look at my own decision-making and discernment processes, man, that's how and where we become. It's in those moments of indecision.
Yeah. I say, yeah, like I know exactly what you're talking about. Say a little more about that, if you don't mind. How is that uncertainty formative?
It's funny. So it was maybe in 2016. I'd released a book in 2015, and I was kind of paying attention to what my next project might be. I'm not one of those writers who's like, I'm going to write a book every 2 years. I mean, mm-hmm. some people are. I'm not one of them, my friend. Yeah. It's just not going to be my life. But if I have something I'm excited about or something that's interesting to me, or something that's bothering me, which, you know, Dallas Willard said that's maybe one of the most transformational questions we can ask ourselves. One of the most revolutionary questions is, what's bothering you? Mm-hmm. Every change that we make in our lives starts out with something bothering us. Anybody who's ever impacted change in the world is because they're bothered by something. Mm-hmm. Mr. Rogers said that he was bothered by children's programming, which is why he started his own show. He was angry about it. Yeah. And so this bothering is catalyst for really beautiful things. And as a writer, I think my job is to pay attention to the world within me, the world around me, and how they interact. And so what I started to pay attention to in 2016-ish was how bothered I got when I had a decision to make. I started to just, I was thinking about going to grad school. It was one of those decisions that is a very privileged decision, right? Not everybody has this decision, but I had it and I couldn't make it. And I started to almost like get meta about it. Like I was watching myself not be able to make this decision. And I paid attention to all the factors I was bringing in. I was getting a lot of advice. I was looking at the pros and cons. Listen, pro con list, love hate relationship with those because they don't, not every item on the pro con list weighs the same amount. So it's not just like whichever one is more. So that's sort of how this all started, of me being kind of low key obsessed with not just, should I go to grad school or not? I did, by the way, spoiler alert, I ended up going. But it was really in the process of making that decision that I started to notice my own posture toward God was different. My own openness toward others was different. I was more open to feedback, to self-reflection. I was mm-hmm. open to the person who I was and was becoming. I was paying attention to what made me come alive and what didn't. I was paying attention to what was life-giving and life-draining. These are reflection practices. And I suppose in all of that, you know, over the year or so that it took me to make that decision and to kind of do the next right thing, I recognized I was becoming someone. I was becoming someone who paid attention to my past and my present life. I was naming my own core values, what really mattered and what kind of didn't. Because the thing is when we start to make decisions based on someone else's rubric, then we are in danger of living someone else's life.
Yeah.
And so the idea of decision-making and discernment being a formative process is one that comes deeply from my own experience, mm-hmm. is because if we never had a decision to make or a move to discern, we would just keep going on. We wouldn't need others. We wouldn't need God. We wouldn't need to look back. But it's those decisions are sort of like It's almost like they trick us into becoming the people we were meant to become, because we are forced to slow down and to ask questions and to lean on people and community around us.
Yeah. I love something you say on the topic of living somebody else's life. When you're not really paying attention to who you are, what you want, questions like this, you may be living somebody else's life. And one of the dangers in that is that you might succeed.
You might succeed.
It happens all the time.
Yeah, it happens all the time.
Yeah. I love that. I love that insight. Something else from what you just said. Now, I can't remember the language you were just using, but it made me think of a really important principle that you talk about is pointing and calling.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to camp out there for just a few minutes. Well, what do you mean what is pointing and calling? What do you mean by that?
Well, when we're in a space that we have started to question, like let's just use, a lot of people, it's a job commitment that they're in. And you start to question and wonder, like, is it time for me to move on from this job or not? What we often want to do is to decide yes or no. And we start to like look at all the things that are terrible about the job, mm-hmm. and the things that we hate, the things that could be better. And that's one way of pointing and calling. The phrase pointing and calling is really from the Japanese railway system. They have this practice that they have implemented called pointing and calling. And it's really just a safety practice. And it's exactly what it sounds like. The railway workers, when a train comes into the station, they will point at the signal and they'll point at it with their body. And they'll say, signal is green. And they'll point at the speedometer as the train moves away from the station. And they'll point at it and they'll say out loud how fast the train is moving.
To themselves, to other people?
They do it to one another. They do it. And it's, you can watch a video on YouTube about it. And it's like, they're just kind of doing like these very obvious movements of they point to the thing and they say it. And then it may even be repeated by another train worker, almost like you would hear at a fast food restaurant, someone call out the order and then someone else calls it back. That's another way of pointing and calling. Uh-huh. My mom did this when I was little. Every time we'd leave the house, she'd check the stove. She'd look not only and look at it and see that the oven knobs were pointed to off, but she would say out loud with her voice, off, 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 so that she could remember, yes, not only did I check it, but I said it out loud. That was a form of pointing and calling. And the reason why this is important, and this reason why I think it's a great example as something to think about, to illustrate in our minds, is that the same way we do that, the Japanese railway workers do that to create a more safe railway system, which, by the way, it worked. 85% of workplace errors were reduced because of this system that they implemented.
And by the way, they're pointing out obvious things, right?
They're pointing out the most obvious things. The signal is green. But we can do this for our inner life as well when it comes to discernment and decision making. Because sometimes when we have our mindset, like when we begin to think like I'm bothered at work, we won't maybe point out the obvious things. We'll just point out the bad things.
Hmm.
To sort of prove our point of like, it's time to go, and it may be time to go. But before we make that decision, it's really important to implement a practice of pointing and calling. And, you know, I helped do this in the book by asking 10 specific questions to help you point and call. But really, any amount of questions, you know, and there's a million questions you could ask yourself. But the point is to point and call to not only the things that are bothering you in the space where you're in, but also the things that are lovely, the people who are there around you, also the people who have left before you, the people who are entering now. Are there things about this room that are true still as they were when you got here? Or are the things that have changed? If so, what are they? And the idea is to say them out loud to yourself, even if you just write them in a journal or something, some way of documenting this is what's true. But the key is to do it without judgment and to do it without thinking you have to take immediate action.
You said noticing, not diagnosing.
That's right.
Yeah. Which is really hard to do.
Oh, it takes so much practice because we're so used to doing that, diagnosing.
Yeah, we approach it like a sophomore essay where I've got my thesis and now I'm looking for proof to show that my thesis is correct. You know, it's time to go. That person's a jerk. I'm not getting paid enough, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And, it's, you know, you say something along the lines of you might have to help me here, but basically, you know, the questions that you're asking are not why questions.
Mm-hmm.
I think of those 10 questions that you alluded to, I don't think any of them are why related. They are, and we think of why as sort of the beginning of wisdom. And you're making the case that not necessarily.
You know, I maybe do my, somewhere I along do, the line,
maybe later.
Maybe later, exactly.
Yeah. But we don't start with why.
I don't start with why. I have found it to be deeply unhelpful most of the time. And part of that is because there's a lot of pressure. We already are meaning-making creatures, and we're already trying to find the meaning in something. And sometimes it's just not time yet, or we're too close to it, or we don't have enough information. Yeah. And so the idea of this discernment framework is to give you more time, to give you some distance, and to give you more information so that eventually maybe you will know why, maybe you won't. Sometimes there is no why. But I do, in my, some of my day job is as a spiritual director, I sit with people and listen to people who are wanting to explore their life with God and their own inner life. And, you know, in our training, we're taught, we don't ever ask why, because the person, if they knew why, they probably wouldn't be sitting across from us. You know, they don't, and there's a lot of pressure, like, and why can sometimes be incriminating. It's almost like, well, why do you feel that way? Well, that's not a question anybody feels comfortable really answering. And you feel almost like you've done something wrong when you're asked that question. And so instead of asking more, you know, who, what, where, when, you know, questions that are a little bit more object, not maybe not even objective, but aren't so much in me, inside of me. It's more like, here's what's happening. Here's what I see. You know, this is a data point, but it's not necessarily a diagnosis.
Yeah. So when you say what questions, what's wrong with you is not one of those questions. Is
yeah,
that, is
probably
that
not. Probably okay. Not.
just trying to clarify. Yeah, that tendency to skip. Now, I'm afraid we're going to have to get rid of about a third of the self-help books on the self-help category if we delay the why question. There's so much start with why. Some of your insights in this book really are, they do ultimately, they're about why. I mean, it's what is it that motivates me? What is it that I want? That's kind of a why.
Totally. And I think, again, I think starting with why could be a helpful process depending on what the question is. You know, if you're starting a business, if you're starting something, then you might, you know, want to start with the big picture of, you know, what motivates me, like you said, like what am I passionate about and how, why is this important? Why me? Why now? Those might be more important questions for starting. But a lot of times when we talk about walking into a room, the reality is that there's a room we just left. And usually that's where a lot of our questions are. It's not starting something, it's ending something. Mm. And so in that space, I think sometimes it's maybe not, maybe why is still important, but I think why is harder to get to. Mm. And so starting with some more external data points can be a gentler entry into the discernment process.
Yeah. And again, it helps us avoid an overconfident, an unearned confidence in our understanding of
why.
Yeah,
that's good. That's a good way to put that. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not going to quote something that is counterintuitive or it's certainly not self-evident. Okay. You say asking why doesn't. Okay, this is paraphrase, and you can tell me if I misparaphrase. Asking why doesn't tell us what to do next.
That's right.
That requires some explanation.
So I can tell you all day long why something is true, why I should leave my job, why I don't like the person in the cubicle next to me, why I want to make more money. But then it's like, okay, well, then in this process of, okay, it's time to leave. Well, what's the next right thing then? And I think that it could be just like, well, leave then. But I don't think you've got enough information. And so, you know, I think that there have been times when I have thought I need to make a sweeping big move in a job. But when I start to do a point and call practice of asking myself various questions, I start to pay attention to, well, what's life giving here? What's life draining here? What are some beautiful things about this room? What are some parts of the room that I'm avoiding? Mm-hmm. When I start asking myself this question, I realize like, oh, I thought I had to quit, but really I just needed to have one difficult conversation with my boss. It's not the whole thing. It was a part of the thing. But because the one part, I had not taken the time to name the part, then the part informed the whole. Yeah. And that was then, well, why do you want to leave? Well, I'm not happy here. Well, I don't like, you know, well, yeah. Let's kind of get down to what's really happening in this space.
Yeah. That question of what in this room am I avoiding is a really hard question to deal with.
It is, because there's a reason you're avoiding it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, yeah. And so to ask someone to name that and to turn the light on it with that is a bold thing to do, which is why I want to walk with someone through a whole book and not just in one conversation.
Yeah.
Because that is a really hard thing to do. But the areas where we're avoiding, those are really key spaces in a room, in a commitment, in a relationship, that it, again, looking at them does not mean we're supposed to leave. It might mean we are more committed to staying than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is the thing is there, whether you acknowledge it or not.
Yeah.
And whatever the thing we're avoiding is still informing my next right thing. It's informing my decisions. It's just informing them sideways. And so I always, you know, I cling on in many ways to what Father Ronald Rollheiser says in his book, The Holy Longing. He says, we get into trouble whenever we don't name things properly.
Mm-hmm.
And so pointing and calling is just another way of naming things properly.
Yeah. And my guess is when you start that process, and I'm saying this as a person who hasn't started the process, there's a good chance you will not name properly early in the process, and you got to get better at naming.
I think so. I think this is just like anything else. You know, some people say, well, I'm just not good at making decisions. And I would say that may be true, but it's the same. You know, I would say the same thing to someone who's like, well, I'm just not a good cook. Well, if you want to be, you can be. This can be learned. And I think the same thing goes for decision making. I think the same thing goes for decision making and discernment, is that it's not necessarily, I mean, some people are born more naturally prone to wisdom, mm-hmm. or, you know, discernment or observation, but I still think it's something we can all, and really are all invited to learn as human people in the world.
Yeah. And I have to say, being decisive really isn't the same thing as being discerning. I mean, there are people who are just naturally good at charging ahead.
That's right. Yeah, I think they could definitely overlap in the Venn diagram of the mm-hmm. discernment decision-making world. But decisiveness does not always equate to discernment. It's not always the same thing. Can be.
Yeah.
But not always.
Yeah. Okay, I know we've already touched on this, but I thought it was so interesting. I want to hear a little bit more about it. You have a acronym, P-R-A-Y. We've talked at length about the P is pointing and calling.
Mm-hmm.
The R is remembering your path, and then acknowledging presence and yield to the arrows. But remembering your path, again, it's really hard to get out of the mindset that discernment and even decision-making is a process of looking into the future and predicting, of seeing what path lies ahead. And you say that the only path available to us is the one we've already walked. The path emerges as we walk. So you say the good work then is not to find the path before us, but to understand the path behind us. Again, not a self-evident insight. So maybe we're done talking about this, but I have a feeling you have a few other things to say about this topic.
Well, I think what I'll simply add to it, and it, you know, I'm someone who probably is more prone to reflection than maybe your average Jane.
Mm-hmm.
And so someone who is more future oriented, this might be a really difficult practice.
Mm-hmm.
I'll also say, in this framework, the P-R-A-Y framework, you don't never look ahead. It's not that we never look
right.
ahead. It's just not the first, second, or third thing we do. It's the fourth thing.
Okay.
And so it's really just, to me, I have found it to be helpful to find ways to slow myself down, because a lot of my anxiety comes when I start to look into the foggy future, when I have a decision to make and I'm trying to discern. Because what we're doing when we try to look into the future, we're trying to mitigate loss and regret a lot of times.
Yeah.
We're trying to preemptively avoid future stress, future regret, and making the wrong choice. We deeply want to make the right choice. And that is, those circumstances, all those feelings I just named, are really tricky circumstances to make a decision under when we're carrying that type of stress. And so a lot of us will, a lot of times we'll put the decision off, which, by the way, is a decision in and of itself. Mm-hmm. Or we might rush through it just to get the thing done already. And we're like, well, we'll deal with it later. If something happens that I don't like, I'll just change it. And so really the PRA is a way to give us as much information, insight, company, as we can possibly get, so that when it comes to time to yield to the arrows, which is taking a step in a direction, whether or not we know it's right, we're never going to know for sure, but we've done the work, right? The communal work of discerning as best we can with what we know at the time, what our next right thing is. And then we move. Marie Forleo talks about clarity, two things about clarity. One, she says clarity cannot be rushed. And that's really the PRA. But she also says clarity comes through engagement, not through thought. And that's the why, which or the why, the letter Y of the PRAY framework, which is yield to the arrows, which is just do the next right thing that you know at the time. And you take a step in a direction. And so I think that, you know, for those future oriented or those who like really want to look into the future, like, of course, we're going to do that at some point. It's just not the first step.
Yeah. So the P and the R and the A are about buying time, among other things?
I guess
and information.
The shortest way to say it, sure. I think the P, R, and A are, if we have the time, you know, obviously if you have a decision to make in the moment, that's what we call an on-the-spot decision. And Iris Murdoch, who is an Irish philosopher and novelist, says that at the moment, the crucial moments of choice, most of the business of decision-making has already passed, which means that the person who I am becoming on the daily really does matter. That's how I am being informed is going to inform what I do when it's time for me to make an on-the-spot decision. But not all decisions are on the spot. And so when we have something that we're trying to discern, you know, pointing and calling, remembering our path and acknowledging presence, ours, others, and the presence of God with us, those are things that are going to help us, like you say, buy time and also fortify our courage and wisdom. You know, sometimes we're needing to find patience because it's not time to do anything yet, but we feel ready. Other times we need to find courage because guess what? It's time to move and we don't feel ready at all. Yeah. But that readiness and timeliness conversation is one that's really important in the discernment process, because if they lined up perfectly, we probably wouldn't need the process because we'd be ready and it'd be time.
Yeah. Yeah. Readiness and timeliness. That was a helpful distinction that you made. Another distinction that's worth talking about, because we're talking about, I mean, you're very much talking about leaving one situation to enter into another. And we'll skip the hallway. You talk about there being a hallway, sort of a liminal space between the rooms, and we may or may not get to that. But you talk about the difference between peace, actual peace, and just avoiding pain, or avoiding conflict, or avoiding anything that feels unpeaceful. Tell me more about that.
Well, I think when we say the word peace, we all probably have images and narratives around that word, what we think it means, what we've experienced it to mean. And sometimes what we mean is the peace that comes from doing the deeply right thing. Mm-hmm. Other times what we might mean is the peace that comes from the relief of avoiding discomfort.
Yeah.
And I think if we all got quiet and really honest with ourselves and gave ourselves space to know the difference, we would probably all be able to name the difference, how it feels in our bodies when we've that peace that comes from doing the deeply right thing versus the peace that comes from just, oh, I'm so relieved I avoided that difficult conversation. And this is important because when we are discerning, A, whether or not to leave a space, or when we're discerning the next space to walk into, sometimes we are confronted with these two different types of peace. And we make our decisions based on our definition of peace at the time. So I grew up in the church and I would often hear, my mom and her friends say things like, well, I just didn't feel a peace about it. Mm-hmm. So I didn't go forward with it because I didn't have a peace. Like it was a something you could hold and, you know, put in your purse. I didn't have a peace about it. And, you know, I'm maybe neutral on that saying. I think that's, you know, that can be true or not true, depending. But I think my second question beneath that would be, well, what do you mean by peace? Mm-hmm. You know, is it that you feel relieved that you don't have to do the hard thing? Or do you feel deeply convinced and convicted and sure that this is the right thing for you to do? And I think that whatever our narrative of peace is can sometimes determine our next step mm-hmm. more than really doing the thing that maybe we feel most compelled to at this time in our life, the thing that would actually be most aligned. Sometimes mm-hmm. the most aligned decision is the hardest one to make, and it brings the most disruption, but mm-hmm. it doesn't mean it was the wrong decision. And it doesn't mean there's not peace there. It just means this is really hard and it feels deeply uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. You use the phrase narrative of peace. That's interesting. By that, I think you mean, you can tell me if I'm getting this right. My definition of peace, if I'm thinking of it in terms of an absence of conflict, an absence of discomfort, mm-hmm. that's a narrative. Whereas something more like shalom, yes. you know, a right ordering of things often happens by way of conflict and by way of discomfort.
Unfortunately, yes, yeah. That's right.
I love your insight that shalom, you say shalom when you're coming and when you're going.
Yeah, a blessing for entering and a blessing for goodbye.
Yeah, yeah. Coming into the room and leaving the room. Okay, you're, for the most part, in How to Enter a Room, you're talking about sort of life-size decisions and choices, you know. Church, work, family, you know. Look, can we bring this down to maybe smaller questions? I mean, a lot of writers listen to this show. A lot of people who do creative work of various kinds. And I do hear from a lot of people who have questions about deciding which project to, you know, I've got lots of ideas. I never know which project to pursue, or I'll pursue one for a while. And I don't know if should I try to finish this book, or should I move on to something else? In my own life, a lot of that is a matter of procrastination. It's easier to think about the book I'm not writing than the book I'm
Amen.
Writing.
That's the truth.
Could you provide some wisdom and insight for? Because I have a hard time answering that question. I get the question pretty often and don't do a great job of answering. I should probably just say, go listen to Emily P. Freeman's podcast is what I should probably say. But
well, it's so funny because I feel the same way as you in many ways, is that if there were a rubric for this, I think somebody probably would have already come up with it and they'd be, you know, a trillionaire, because all of us creatives would be clamoring for whatever that rubric is. However, I do think that this discernment process of pointing and calling, of remembering your path, of acknowledging presence and yielding to arrows can fit for something even like deciding which room of a project you might want to enter next, like what thing you want to work on. And sometimes, you know, as artists and creatives and makers, you know, we already don't think in a linear way. That's why we're not managers. You know, we're makers, that we embody time in a way that is broad and expansive, and we need long runways to get started and we need long runways to finish. You know, we're not helicopter people. We're not coming in and out of projects like a manager would, like just schedule my day hour by hour. No, we won't ever get any work done that way. And the same goes for our projects, is that like we need these long spaces and these big times to consider. And that means, though, that the pressure's on when we discern which projects we're entering into, because we know this is a huge commitment.
Yeah.
And if I do the work required to get deep into this creative space in order to do this work well, and I choose wrong, wow, what a waste of my time. Yeah. That's how we can think. And so I appreciate the question because it feels really important. I said the phrase waste my time. And so that's why I'm now going to counter myself and say, I don't even know if I believe in the phrase waste your time, just like okay. I'm not sure I believe in writer's block. Seth Godin talks about you don't have talker's block. You just talk. So you're just afraid of writing badly. You know, that it's not really writer's block. It's just, you know, bad writer's block. But I think the same thing for when it comes to creative work. All of the work that we're doing is we're always becoming someone just in decision-making. Yeah. So even the process of deciding about what project to do next, there's a really interesting thing that happens if we move through the discernment process in deciding that, is that we start to know and name what matters most to us, what makes us tick, some of our own core values. If you're a spiritual person, some ways your own spiritual personality, how I connect with God, what I want to exist in the world, that I'm kind of the one to do it. I think sometimes I heard a Kristen Chenoweth, who was the original Glenda on Broadway. She was interviewed and she talked about when she has scripts come across her desk. She said, I always, when I read a script, I always ask myself the question, is this Kristen Chenoweth and nobody else? And if I can imagine someone else doing it, then I pass. But if I have almost like an envy over this role, and if I saw someone else get it, I would be mad if they did it. That's a way of pointing and calling. It's not to say absolutely do it or absolutely don't, but it can be a way, just a one bit of information that's helpful, at least for me, to think, I have this book idea that's sort of noodling around my mind. And this has happened to me before, where I have this idea and then I don't jump on it. And then someone else writes the book, or I see that someone else is doing it. It's gone both ways for me. Sometimes I'm like, I'm so mad. Like, why didn't I do that when I had the chance? Because now it feels like I'm copying. I've also had times where I hear someone else is working on a thing very similar, and I'm like, oh, thank God I don't have to do that thing.
Yeah.
And I think we can trick our imagination of making that scenario happen in our minds and paying attention to how we feel. If someone else were to do this project, would I be relieved? Or would I be jealous and envious and wish I had done it? Again, not a for sure I should do this one or that one, but it's one bit of information that could be helpful.
Yeah. I think it's hard, though, for a lot of writers to have sufficient confidence to say, no, I really am the person for this.
Yeah, I know. And that's a whole process in and of itself, is to, I just talked with a writer the other day, a young writer who is kind of discerning, like, what's my next great thing? And half our conversation was like, I got the sense, she didn't say this, but I got the sense that she was waiting until she felt confident in order to do the work.
Yeah.
And what I told her, unfortunately, is that part of the work is doing the work with zero confidence. Yeah. It actually is the job of a writer and an artist to do it anyway, even though it might not work, even though someone else could do it better, even though, you might feel like you're wasting your time, because the reality is someone else can do it better and they probably already have, but that doesn't mean you can't do it too.
I wrote a biography of Flannery O'Connor and it was really hard because not only did I suspect there were lots of other people who would do better, I could name them.
Of course, I
knew the names of people who were better qualified.
Absolutely. We all have
although they weren't writing the book and I was. And so.
That's right. It's almost like the worst news and the best news, because it's the worst because you compare yourself, but then it's the best because it's like, okay, well, what am I going to do about it? Am I going to let it stop me? Or just because someone else has said it doesn't mean I can't say it too. And the beauty of that is that we've all heard stuff a million times. We all have stories in our own lives where we've heard stories, we've seen movies, we've heard sermons, whatever, a million times. But then there's like that seventh, that 10th, that 18th time we hear it, that it just clicks something in us the way that person said it at that time in our life. And we might be that person for somebody else. Yeah, we're repeating a thing. Everything's a remix anyway. Yeah. But maybe when we say it with our unique personality and our spin on life, it will meet someone in a space in a different way than it's ever been met before.
Yeah. And I will say this with the Flannery O'Connor book. When it was over, I was the only person who could have written it. That particular book. I mean, it looks like a book that I would write about Flannery O'Connor. And hopefully somebody in the world needed it.
That's right.
All right. Emily, typically end with a question that I didn't give you fair warning on, but I'm going to just ask it anyway. Who are the writers who make you want to write?
Oh, man.
Not the same thing as who are your favorite writers.
Uh-huh. When I read Natalie Goldberg, and she writes about writing, so maybe that's not fair, but she, every time I read her, I write afterwards. Like it just compels me to, she makes it sound so accessible.
I need to read Natalie Goldberg then.
It makes me want to write.
Yeah.
I think Madeline L'Engle is that way to a degree. Yeah. Modern day, I would say there's a writer who's also a friend of mine. Her name's Shannon Martin. And whenever I read her Substack or even her Instagram captions, I'm like, she makes me want to be better.
Mm. Well, good. All right. Emily P. Freeman, this is so fun. Thank you. Your book came along at a good time for me. And so I hope a lot of people read it. A lot of people benefit from it.
Thanks so much for having me.
This podcast is brought to you by The Rabbit Room, where art nourishes community and community nourishes art. And all our podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our members. To learn more about us, visit rabbitroom.com. And to become a member, rabbitroom.com/donate.